Dargraith Publishing presents The Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101 for summer semester 2014. Lecture 2, delivered on June 5, 2014. The title of this lecture is Supply, Demand, and Elasticities.
Tonight, Supply, Demand, and Elasticity. I do want to make sure that you understand the story of supply and demand very clearly. What our assumptions are when we talk about supply and demand. The law of demand, as I've already pointed out, as the price of a good or service goes up, the quantity demanded will go down, and vice versa. Now, I'm putting this on the board just to point out it's price that's driving. Nothing else will change this quantity demanded. If you're talking about a change in demand, that's something else, and I brought that up before, and I'll go into it in more detail right now. But as the price of a good or service goes up, the quantity demanded goes down. And that's pretty simple to think about. Although, interestingly enough, there are cases, I hate this word law of demand, because there are actual rare but appallingly important cases where we see the law of demand being exactly what doesn't happen. In other words, in any kind of normal situation, when you're plotting quantity against price, as the price goes up, the quantity demanded is going to go down. That's the way almost every normal good in the world works. Delta P greater than zero means that delta QD, and put this in your notes, because when your notes have all this math in them, it looks really cool and mom can put it up on the refrigerator. But don't think that the math is any kind of reason, and a graph isn't a reason either. They're just old tools that we still use to this day, but the logic is, look, if the price of something goes up, you're not going to want as much of it. It doesn't change your demand. Your demand is some fundamental thing that's changed by others, but it's just that you can't buy as much of it. If you're into, have any of you taken calculus? Okay. Well, if you're into calculus, the derivative of quantity with respect to price is negative. It's just saying that it's a negatively sloped line. But let me bring up real quick, and I'll explain the theory behind it in a little bit later, but I'll point out that there are a few goods in the world where you see an upward sloping supply, a demand curve. In other words, it actually violates the law of demand. A normal demand curve is downward sloping. But we do see demand curves once in a while that as the price goes up, the quantity demanded increases. And when we see this, it is oftentimes associated with a genuine human tragedy on a large scale. I'll explain a good example of where we saw this, and then an even more interesting example. There were times in China and in Asia where rice is a staple. It is absolutely the most basic good of all, where the price of rice skyrocketed because of supply disruptions, warlord problems, environmental, a bad harvest or two, and the price of the stuff, of the rice, went through the roof. What we saw the poor people doing, the millions of poor people, they would simply stop buying everything else and just pour all of their income into buying rice and hoarding it. In other words, we were seeing the price go up and people were demanding more of it. And why? What is that all about? Well, it's logical for them because this is such a fundamental part of their diet, of their culture, that they would defend that and get rid of everything else in their budget, including other foods that provided nutrients. Rice actually isn't that nutritious. And the other foods in their diet that would have provided them with what they wanted, the other things they needed, they stopped buying them. And so you had mass starvation. They had rice. They had stores of rice. They'd wiped out their income on it. And they starved to death because they didn't have all the other things that they needed to eat. Probably another example of this, I don't know if they teach this in history classes anymore, but there was a potato famine in Ireland in the 19th century. Did they bring that up in classes anymore? It was a brutal, brutal thing. And it was driven, interestingly enough, by a disease that hit the potatoes. Now, the story behind it is that the British government, the British monarchy, the parliament, didn't like the Irish, didn't like the Irish Catholics, and so what they did was they started importing exclusively, allowing Ireland to buy only one kind of potato, a potato that was particularly susceptible to a potato rot. And so the Irish farmers, not knowing this, planted just this kind of potato, and sure enough, the rot hit it and dropped the supply, supply of the potatoes. I mean, you were pulling potatoes out of the ground, and as soon as you cut them open, they were just black inside. You see that once in a while with potatoes in the stores, but not often. I mean, we're talking about 80, 90% of the potato yield was rotten, couldn't be eaten at all. So what did the Irish? The prices started skyrocketing on edible potatoes, the impoverished Irish just spent all their money on those potatoes. A couple of potatoes might cost them a week's income. They would just use that week's income for the potato because it was that fundamental to their culture, to their diet. And of course, they didn't have anything else. There were other foods they could have bought, but they didn't have the money for those because they had actually, as a price rose, they hoarded the potatoes that were good, and then they didn't have any money left for anything else, and so they starved. They starved to death. We see this with heroin addicts. When we do these drug interdictions, massive seizures of drugs, and all of the heroes of drug enforcement tout, show off, and strut around, yeah, that's going to really drive up the price of heroin. And the heroin addicts start dying, because they'll pay every penny they've got for the higher-priced heroin, upward-sloping supply demand curve, and sure enough, spank me, Jesus, they die because they don't eat, because they've blown all their money on horse. And that's just the way it works. So the upshot of this is that price and demand normally follow this law. But when they don't, the consequences are darn bad. It's the Wile E. Coyote phenomenon. You notice that most of the time when the Roadrunner and the Wile E. Coyote are running around, the gravity is working for the coyote. But sometimes he goes off a cliff, and that's when gravity doesn't work, and he just stands there for a minute realizing, oh, and then he falls to his death. When the law of gravity doesn't work for the coyote, it kills him. And this is the same thing. When the law of demand doesn't work for people, it kills them too. Okay. Enough of that. Now, I've got to take you through supply. Oh, let me bring up something here. I talked about this last time. You will notice me doing this in lectures. You'll notice me doing this in lectures from time to time. A lot of times. I'll introduce something, and then later in the next lecture or in a couple lectures, I'll bring it up again in a more formal sort of fashion. The law of demand has to do with movements along a demand curve. But demand curves can shift, and they do. And quite honestly, speaking as a business professor, Our whole job is not to ride a demand curve. Our whole job is to move demand curves in marketing. That's our job. Demand is going to be whatever it is. What we got to do is figure out how to get that demand curve to do something interesting for us, or to get our competitor's demand curve to do something not so exciting for him or her. There we go. So, demand curves. Okay, demand curves usually shift outward. When income goes up, demand goes up. And here we're talking about real demand, the demand curve. However, interestingly enough, that's not quite as simple as that. You see, sometimes, say income goes up by, your income goes up by 10%. Are you going to buy 50% more toilet paper? No. Yeah, you might buy a little more or a higher quality of toilet paper, but you're not going to go bananas. So we have what are called normal goods. So to give you just a number for it, if income changes, percent change in income of 10% would lead to somewhere between a 0 and 10% change upward in demand. Just some fancy notation there. Shorthand is our friend when we get to more complex subjects like this. So make sure you understand what I just said here. A percent change, say, if it's a percent change in income of 10%, and the demand for this kind of product moves from 0 to 10% up, well, we call that a normal good. Now, there are some goods, though. Woman, how much wine do you drink? Lots? No. Jugs? Well, someday you will. When you get your income goes up by 50%, you're going to start buying wine. Chateau Neuf de Derrière or something like that. You know, I don't know. Ninth house of the ass. Okay. See, it's when your income goes up, there will be a time when you will buy a lot more of some things than you do now. I mean, you will buy a little more of most things, but a lot more of some things. You have a yacht? Do you have a yacht?
I do not.
Well, you will someday. You will spend the money. Now, someday you're going to be fat. And you're going to be impotent. Now, let's say that happens tomorrow. You wake up and you look in the mirror. Hey, I'm Fat Albert. I don't give a shit about women. Okay? You understand what's happened. You can't do anything about it. You can't fix it. But suppose that your income suddenly skyrockets when you get your first big job. Then you're going to be at the gym. Then you're going to be at the doctor getting all those things fixed. You're going to have a percent change in income that will be associated with a much larger than that percent change in the demand for some products, a few products. We see that, for example, have you ever had plastic surgery? Someday you'll need it. Mm-hmm. Seriously. I mean, no, don't be depressed because we can fix you for a price. But you see, until you make more money, you're just going to have to get older and uglier. And I mean, you know, it's just going to be sort of like, you know, God, woman, that's like a prune, that face. Damn. But then your income's going to go up and you're going to spend lots of money to get that face fixed. And you're going to have that butt tuck you've been thinking about. Seriously, that's for the ladies, of course, obviously. But you're going to have all those things done that are more a percent demand. Your percent change in demand for those will be more than your percent change in income. You'll own that yacht that you've been dreaming of. You'll hire a couple of young Cougar Bates. Things like that. We call those goods luxury goods or superior goods. When the percent change in income of 10% or any percentage leads to more than a 10% change upward in demand. And the book calls these I think the book's term for them is superior goods. The old economics term, which apparently is not politically correct anymore, luxury goods. We used to call them luxury goods. No, we get to that next. Those are superior goods because you get a little bit of a raise in income and boom, you get a lot more of this kind of product. As a matter of fact, there are actually products you probably will encounter with small changes in income. You'll buy more than that percent change of that product. I'm trying to think of things that, is there anything when you get a little bit of extra money in your paycheck, you would buy a lot more of that? Like anything? You know, decent beer instead of Earp Light? I don't know. I mean, you might go to a decent restaurant for once, but okay, those are superior or luxury goods, and you will see more of those as your income goes up. Obviously, you'll make a lot more money because you've been in this class, and they'll see that you were taught by me, and they'll pay you huge money, or not. Jesus Christ, he screwed up you too. Okay, now, there's another kind of good, a weird kind of good, and they are very common, though. And these are goods that when your income goes up, your demand for these shifts back. And when your income goes down, your demand for these shifts outward. We call these inferior goods. Believe it. You got it. Ramen noodles. The ramen noodles aren't a crime, man. You know? They are not. I mean, okay, here's another one. White Castles. Uh-huh. Seriously, I mean, if you want cramps, that's the thing. When you're poor, you don't have time to buy fancy foods that'll give you diarrhea. You need it right away. Uh-huh. Inferior goods. Cigarettes are a powerful inferior good. The poorer you are, the more likely you are to smoke heavily. And when you have a lot of income and suddenly you lose your job, you're going to puff them cigarettes like you wouldn't believe. Inferior goods, a percent change upward in income of 10% would lead you to buy less of that product. Ramen noodles are a great example. White Castles are example. How often do you see rich people at White Castle? They don't go to White Castle. Poor people do. Huh? Oh, well, no, not. Man, the drive-thru, I mean, that's even worse than the inside. I mean, those people go through the drive-thru. What they're doing in the cars while they're eating those, that's nasty. Alcohol, low-grade alcohols, malt liquors are a phenomenon of the poor. Interestingly enough, cocaine is a superior good. Crack cocaine is an inferior good. And which is kind of one of the things economists like me point out to our wonderful genius legislators. You make the laws, the punishment for possession and use of crack enormously higher than for powdered cocaine. The fact of the matter is that powdered cocaine is the toy of the rich. Crack cocaine is the toy of the poor. Ditto for meth. Meth is a phenomenon of the poor. As your incomes go down, you will be more likely to see poor people using those kinds of substances. Superior goods are the pharmaceuticals that are essentially nothing but legal versions of illegal drugs. Those are what you buy when you have a lot of money. You can go to the doctor, and the doctor will understand your problems, and he'll give you essentially what is the equivalent of controlled LSD and mescaline and methamphetamines. Those are superior goods, and they are legal. They are perfectly legal. But so we know that there is this play on inferior goods that our politicians just love to whack people with those, tax them, put high penalties, criminal penalties on possession, use, sale, knowing very well that it's the poor people that use them, and the poor people don't have any political power. So, hell, you're going to pander to the masses and to the rich people who don't want those poor people anywhere near them. Better to have them in prison where they can work as slave laborers. Let's go. Inferior, normal, superior, or luxury goods. So if I were to say, okay, your income went from, let's say, $10,000 to $15,000, that would be a 50% increase in your income. And I said, well, you are buying, you used to buy 10 apples a week, now you're buying 11 apples a week. That's a 10% increase in your apples that you buy. See, 10 to 11, that would be a 10%. So is that a normal good, inferior or superior good? That's a normal good. It's a normal good. Yeah, you know, your income goes up by a lot, your demand for these goes up a little bit. But if I were to tell you that your income went from $10,000 to $15,000 and your consumption of, let's say a Merlot wine went from nothing to a bottle a week, that's an infinite increase in percentage in your consumption of that wine. That's a bingo, exactly. But at the same time, your income went up from $10,000 to $15,000, you are no longer going to Moe's. You are not going there at all because that stuff gives you gas. And you are instead going to Steak and Shake. So Moe's would be an inferior good in that. Now, this is important for us in marketing, you understand. Because one thing that we talk about when we, as a consultant, I did this and I teach my students about this in business classes, is that strong companies make sure that they have goods of a whole range for their consumers. You see, and the reason is many of the goods that these companies sell are in the normal range. That's your bread and butter, your cash cows. But you also want to make sure that you're providing superior goods so that in good times, as incomes are going up, people surge towards these. Oh, wow, I've never bought this, or I've only had this a couple of times in my life. So they'll buy those because their incomes are going up. But you also must make sure that you have inferior goods in your portfolio as well, so that in the bad times when incomes are going down, you got things that those people can run to that are in your portfolio of products that you can offer them. And that way, essentially, you're doing what we call portfolio hedging. It's the same thing you would do with stocks. Some stocks do well in good times and bad in poor times. Some stocks do bad in good, bad and do well in bad times. So essentially, strong older companies have a what we call a product mix. They have several product lines, and they have even different brand names so that they can have all the different possibilities for different types of income behaviors that happen during the business cycle. Interestingly enough, this is just finished talking about this a couple of weeks ago with my Business 100 students at ISU. The car manufacturers that make sure that they have different cars for different classes of people. So that as you rise in income, they have a car waiting for you as you grow older. So, for example, Toyota. They have actually several brand names, and most people who are well-to-do are not going to buy a Toyota because that's a middle-class people's car. But Toyota has a car waiting for them. What's the brand label for the... Bingo. So that you don't even have to have the smell of your former self on you when your income goes up enough that you can step up to the big league of cars. Nissan does the same thing. Bingo, Infiniti. They change even the brand name, but you see that way they have these superior goods in the portfolio so that they can ride you through your life. Right now you're a poor son of a bitch in college, you know, but someday you're going to be making a lot. Oh, no, not you. you will. The thing, though, is that, you see, that's what we do in business is we want to make sure that people always have something that they can go to in our portfolio. The same is true with all these generic brands. Do any of you buy products that have the Equate label on them? You ever seen it? Oh, yeah. You know, those are actually the same products that are made by the main manufacturers, and they all use a trademark name called Equate to sell them in a cheaper box with no advertising to poorer people. So when times get worse, people go to the Equate. Well, I guess it's almost as good. When times get better, people go to the fancy brands. The salted snacks manufacturers. One of my most enlightened, stupid little things when I was consulting was the first time I went to a factory where they were making tortilla chips. And there was this huge conveyor belt, like this, going down the line. And they were all going off in different directions down there. And I couldn't get back there. And I said, where are they going? And I said, oh, they're bagging. Those are the bagging ports. Oh, bagging. Yeah, that's Lay's. Over there, that's the house brand for Kroger. Over there, that's the house brand for, and they named some store I didn't know. They were the same chips. They were the same damn chips. Wait, you know, are the, those are the same chips? Well, duh. They're just in four-color bags for the good ones. They're in two-color bags for the house brands. And then we got a couple of generic brands, not Home Kettle, I can't remember the name. But, yeah, they're the same chips. So that if you're poor, or if everyone gets poor, they can go to the same chips. But if you're rich, I ain't going to buy that shit. I'm going to buy the stuff in the fancy bag because it tastes better. Yeah, it sure does. Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't. It's the same damn stuff. You can push that too far. There was a wonderful story many years ago. Big Bear, a chain of grocery stores, that probably you don't remember that one, they pioneered completely generic food. The cans were just white with black letters on them. And they had beans. Didn't tell you what beans, it was beans. They had corn. Didn't tell you what kind of corn, just corn. It was so low end, so low priced, that if times got bad, they were betting that if times got really bad, people would try it, and they'd find out they could eat it, and they wouldn't die. It was great, because when I was an undergrad, they actually came out with cans of food. It just said food. and then there was the food with meat, which was 3 cents more. Well, I didn't need the meat, you know. There were rats in the apartment, but that kind of fell apart. As a matter of fact, they even showed that in a movie back in the 1990s. It was called Repo Man. It's not the one that was done a couple of years ago. It was a parody science fiction farce where the kid was eating. He pulled it out of the out of the cupboard. It said food on it. He opened it up and he ate it out of the can. His mom was bitching because he should put it on a plate because it tastes better on a plate. But anyway. Let me talk about, we talked about this last time, and I'm going to bring it up a little more formally this time. I've been sneaking a little bit of a formula here. This is a critical formula, not just here, but in a lot of classes that you'll take. It's a silly little formula. But whenever I want to calculate a percent change in anything at all, I take the ending value, I subtract the beginning value, and then divide that result by the beginning value. And then I times it by 100% to make it turn it into a percent. Don't forget to do that, to make it a percentage. Now, here's the reason percent changes matter. They matter more than absolute. Woman, do you ever eat chocolate? Okay. Now, do you drive a car? Okay. Now, you're looking at a chocolate bar that you really would like to buy. And you're looking at a car that you'd really like to buy. Now, the car is $20,000. The chocolate bar is $1. Now, the price of both of them, they're both come on sale. Your dream has come true. They've both been reduced by 50 cents. I know. Let the good times roll. Candy in a car? Mm-hmm. In your future. Which one is going to make you more excited? The drop of 50 cents in the car or the drop of 50 cents in the candy bar? Capitalist. Yes. You see, the absolute change of 50 cents doesn't matter to us. In business, in economics, in life, it's not the absolute amount that really matters. You know, if you're making $100 a week and you get a raise of $50, that's a hell of a raise. But if you're making $5,000 a week and you get a raise of $50, you know, whoop-de-ding-dong, you see, absolutes don't matter. Percents are what matter. And we know in business, economics, and all of that, that people don't react to absolute changes too much. They react to percent changes. That's why you will most often, when you see coupons for sale and sales, they'll say percent off. They won't say dollars off, hardly ever. They'll say percents off, because we know that people react to the percent much more strongly than they do to a dollar off deal. So, and in fact, interestingly enough, I wanted to test this once. I've got my e-commerce site, and so I put a sale on my artwork. $40 off. There was hardly any change upward in quantity demanded. Hardly any. You know, I got a few more orders. But then when I put that I was going to give people 15% off, there was a strong change upward. Even though 15% off was less than $40 off, people didn't react to the dollar. They reacted much more strongly when I said percent. We know that people behave on percentages. Even if they don't think about it that way, they act on them. So that's why we need to know that, how to do that percent change. So that if I told you that a product went from $1.20 up to $1.50, okay? The percent change in price then would be the ending price minus the beginning price, all divided by the beginning price. Oh, times, and don't ever let me forget to put the 100 times 100%. Now, all of those dollar signs will cancel out. So these are pure numbers. These are pure numbers. So we're except that now when we multiply it by a percent, we get a percentage out of it. Now, that would be 30 cents divided by $1.20. What the hell is that? I so suck at arithmetic. Not four. 40 cents. No, divide. Yeah, 1/4. That's right. Yeah, I knew that. Get off me. And that was a positive there. So, in other words, we can say, well, the price went up by 30 cents. But more relevantly for consumer behavior, the price went up by 25%, which is a pretty strong upsurge in the price. So let's take this one step further. I'll tell you this really briefly, a quick story. A student that I taught here almost 10 years ago, and then he was over at ISU. He majored in economics with a minor in finance over there. And I ran into him about a year and a half ago. I wanted to know what he was doing. He's working for one of the big consumer products companies. I won't mention which one it is. But he said, I'm calculating price elasticities. That's what I do most of the time. I said, you're kidding me. They still do these? He said, yep, they sure do. Okay, well, here's what he's doing, pretty much. We bring the price up from $1.20 up to the $1.50. Now, what we care about, what we really care about, is what happens to the quantity demanded when we do that. We're testing this all the time. We put sales on products. We nudge the price up. Then we see what happens with our sales. We look at it all the time. It drives us crazy. And I'll tell you more about that in a little while here. But okay. Now let's say that the quantity demanded one, at that higher price, at that lower price, let's say that 100 units were bought. But when the price went up to $1.50, let's say that the amount being bought fell down to, let's say, 70 units. That's quantity demanded too. The law of demand is working here. Price goes up, quantity demanded goes down. So, now we know that the quantity demanded went from 100 units down to 70 units. So let's see what happened to the percentage. Percent change, well, I should do this where you can see it. Probably can't see it there. I'll do it. Percent change in quantity demanded is going to be the beginning, 100. Well, I'm sorry, the beginning. I'm sorry, the ending. Jeez. Ending minus beginning over the beginning. That would be negative 30 over 100. Oh, and times 10%. Times 100%. We're timesing it, but we make it percentage. That would be negative 30%. Woman, would you say you're the kind of person who is very calm when things go wrong? Or are you the kind of person who just goes completely wacko bonkers, kill everything in sight?
I go a little wacko, I would say.
You overreact.
Yeah.
I'm looking around the room. You look like someone who underreacts. You know, you could have, you know, I could suddenly turn into a zombie. Brains. Oh, not you. And you just sit there staring at me with that scowl, okay? See, that's underreacting. And that's what we want to know with people and the products that we sell them. Is this the kind of product and the kind of people who overreact? Or is this the kind of product and the kind of people who buy it who underreact? Look at what I did there. Is this the kind of product and the people who buy it who are overreactors or underreactors? You see it, don't you? We call these people price elastic. They overreact. 25% jack up in the price? Well, they went 30% down. They lost their cool. So that is what we want to know. We really, really want to know this. Because once we know this, we know whether we can push the price up or push the price down to get more out of them. And we use a calculation of these two. It's called elasticity. The price elasticity of demand. Now, sometimes you'll see me use some real old-fashioned notation. We used to use a Greek letter, the Greek letter eta for this, and you might see in some books or on some online resources that Greek letter eta, but now the elementary textbooks use a big capital E for it. And the way we calculate that is we take the absolute value of the percent change in quantity demanded over the percent change in price. We turn it into an absolute value because the law of demand will make the actual calculation negative. See that one was negative there, the negative 30%. We say, well, let's look at them all as being positives. So in this case, we would have, the absolute value of negative 30% over 25%. And we see that that's 1.2. That's 1.2. Now, honestly, just to tell you the honest truth, you saw the reactivity of the people, of the consumers, before I do this calculation. I mean, you can see it from just what we did there. All this does is sort of summarize it in a single number. If the price elasticity of demand is bigger than 1.0, then we say that the consumers are price elastic on the demand side. They're price elastic on the demand side. See that 1.2? All that's saying is what we saw over there. Yeah, the quantity demanded reaction is bigger than the action of the price. And if the price elasticity of demand is less than 1, we say that the consumers are price inelastic. They're unreactive. In other words, they don't move too much when the price goes up. And we talked about this a little bit last time. Necessities we see are generally price inelastic. Addictive products are price inelastic. Interestingly enough, there are a couple of other classes of goods, and I talk about these in business courses a lot. Things that are real small ticket items, they tend to be price inelastic. In other words, a cheapo, low price item, people don't seem to react very much at all to the price of it. I talked about this in business classes for this reason. A lot of people want to go into business for themselves, or they think that the whole idea of doing business is to get the Hail Mary product, the product that's going to, you sell a couple of them and you can retire. I said the biggest fortunes in the history of business people wasn't on products that had incredibly high prices. The big, massive family fortunes were done on things like little candies, little toys, pencils, urinal cakes, stupid low-priced products. Because you see, when there is a low price, a cheapo thing like a little toy or a little piece of candy, and your costs go up and you want to pass those along, people aren't going to notice it. Oh, the gumball went from 6 cents to 7 cents. You're not going to notice it. Oh, well, that product right there, that candy, those little toys that the kids like to buy, we're going to bring them up. We've got to bring them up from 20 cents up to 25 cents. That's a hell of a price increase, but it's not noticeable. But if you do that same percentage price increase on a big ticket item, people are going to see it and they are going to react violently to it. So, in other words, one place where you'll see price inelastic products that you don't expect is low ticket items. Big ticket items tend to be much more price elastic than little ticket items. That's why it was a disaster, interestingly enough. There was, sometimes you think having a good cause. And there's been proposals many times over the many years. Let's put a tax on luxury items. Put a big, heavy tax on yachts, on private airplanes, on those things that rich people buy. Hell, they won't notice it. Unfortunately, that's a prescription for disaster. Because, and I'll show you exactly why in just a little while, but a tax was put on yachts many years ago. Rich people, we're going to tax them on yachts. We taxed them on the yachts. Rich people react to price increases. The yacht makers pass those price increases through, and the consumers of those rich people were highly price elastic to those big ticket items. They just stopped buying yachts. So suddenly, the yacht industry died, and all of those working class people who build the yachts lost their jobs, destroyed the industry, and they ended up, instead of punishing the rich people, making them pay more, the rich people just stepped away and bought other things for their pleasure. And what happened was you wiped out a lot of working middle class people's jobs, craftsmen and all that. They lost their jobs because the rich people no longer bought the product because the product had gone up in price. And rich people are price elastic on big ticket items. They can be the chintziest sons of bitches you ever met. But it's interesting that way. There you go. Okay, elasticity. Other things that have to do with elasticity, and I mentioned this one last time, your time frame. People tend to be price inelastic in the short run, but more price elastic in the long run. In other words, people tend to be unreactive to price changes in the short run, but more reactive to price changes in the long run. That's what that story I told you about gasoline going up in price. We know people in the short run, they're just going to bitch and they're going to buy their gas. But if you let that price stay up there, people are going to start figuring out, okay, it's time to buy an electric car. Okay, it's time to start using my bicycle. Okay, it's time to find a more efficient road to work. Okay, it's time to start carpooling. You don't want people to start thinking that. That's why the price will go back down again. So right now, about a week, 2 weeks ago, the price of gas went to $3.99 point stupid. And now it's beginning to ease back down. And of course, you'll have these geniuses on television. Well, there was a supply disruption, but now things seem to be clearing up in the oil on the high seas, and Brent crude is going down in price. Oh, you dumbasses, no. Those kinds of supply is relatively smooth on the high seas, for God's sake. It's all about keeping the price up, but not so long that people start talking about alternatives. You can jack the price of the fuel for our power plants up, coal, oil, and all that. You can jack them up, but you better not leave them up too long, because then the wind turbine manufacturers are going to start partying, and that price on that wind energy won't be so stupidly high as it used to seem. Price relative will be more at parity. I want to bring up one right here. This place, if the price elasticity of demand equals 1, we call this price unit elastic. This is what it's all about, and I'll show you why. We bust our asses to figure out where the price has to be for the demand to be price unit elastic. You see, a typical demand curve, and honestly, real world, I can't see a demand curve. I mean, mathematically, I had to be in grad school, PhD level work, before I knew how to do the kinds of probability theory and statistics to estimate demand curves. Normal people, normal businesses don't have that kind of time or that kind of aggravation. But we do have a way to know what the demand curve is doing. Because you see, a typical demand curve, one thing we know about it is that the price elasticity is not the same along the whole demand curve. We know that. Okay, so let's start with a proposition. Let's say, never mind demand curves, let's talk real world. Let's talk about my business. Okay, now let's talk about the price going from 0 and on up from there. And let's talk about my revenue that I pull in. Now remember, revenue is your price times your quantity. $5 a unit for 10 units, that's $50. Now these are things that I, as a businessman, can see. I can see them. I can see my price, and I can see how much money I put into the cash drawer. You know, never mind cost. Let's talk about just this. I can see what did I charge, and how much money did I make in revenue. Okay, now, logically, if I charge a price of 0 for my product, I know damn well I don't get any money in my drawer. I'm going to have a lot of people want my stuff, but you know who's going to? Well, I'm not going to get any money. So here's a rule. Don't charge 0 for your price. Sure, you'll sell a lot of them, but you won't make any money. So I know that. That's just common sense. One other place where there's common sense is that there is some price that is so stupidly high that no one is ever going to buy my product there. So there is a price somewhere out here. I don't know what it is. Doesn't matter to me right now. But I know damn well that no one's going to buy it. So my revenue would be 0 at that price too. Which means that the entire action has to happen in the middle. Okay, suppose that I was charging 0. Lots of people were buying my product. Quantity demand was incredible. So I finally raise my price to $10. Of course, some people walk away from me. You asshole. Yeah, charging for this, how dare you? So I'm going to lose some customers. They can kiss my ass, but I'll still keep some of them. So I know for a fact that once I bring my price off zero, I'll pull some money into the cash drawer. Now, I don't know how much, but I do know something for a fact, that as I raise my price more and more, I'm going to lose some customers. That's the law of demand. Sure, I will. But I'll still be pulling in revenue. But if I look at this thing that I drew, these two common sense points, the profile of revenue must look like that. Somewhere, there's a peak. On this side of the peak, I raise my price, I lose customers, but I gain revenue. My price increase is better than my consumer loss. But I know that there's some place, I might not know where it is, but I know there's some place where if I raise my price, I lose too many more customers. Sure, I gain a little on price, but I lose too many customers. In other words, what I'm describing to you here is that there is some range. Every product has its own profile. But there's some range where my consumers are price inelastic. And there's some range where my consumers are price elastic. I know that. I know that. It has to be that way. It has to. So in other words, there is a range where my price elasticity of demand is less than 1.0, and there's a range where my price elasticity of demand is greater than or equal to 1.0. So there has to be, just logically, some place where I have exactly a price elasticity of demand of exactly 1.0. We have a name for that in marketing. It's called our price point. That's your price point. Go. Because what's happening is I'm bringing up my price, right? And obviously I'll lose customers, right?
But doesn't that mean it's elastic?
No, because what's happening is that as my, I'm not losing as many customers as I'm gaining on price.
Okay.
You follow me? I'm glad you bring that up. Let me point that out one more time. Is that here, yeah, I'm losing customers. No question, my price is going up. But I'm gaining more on my price per unit than I'm losing on my customers that are walking away from me. So, in other words, my reaction of the consumer universe is inelastic. I'm losing people. Sure I am. But I am gaining more from the price. So, in other words, the loss on top, the loss on top is not as big as the gain on the bottom, so that the ratio is below one. You follow it? Okay. It takes a while to get this in, but the main point is this. In marketing, we are doing this all the time, and I mentioned this just a little while ago, is we're shifting that price around all the time on our products. That's why we do sales. That's why we do price jackups. We're trying to see where we are. Okay, let's do this. Okay, I've tried this over and over again myself. And in the day of consulting, we would do this. We brought our price up by 10% on a couple of sandwiches at a small chain of burger joints that I consulted for. We brought up the price 10% just to see what would happen. The revenues increased. We didn't have as many customers, but what had happened was, in other words, when the price went up, total revenue went up. We must have been on this side of the curve. That meant that they were originally pricing too low, because when we brought up the price, we made more money. So in other words, God, I think it was like 80 cents for like a silver dollar burger. They made sort of like White Castles. They were silver dollar burgers, 80 cents a piece. So we brought them up to 88 cents. And we actually, the revenues in the drawer at the end of the week were larger than they had been the week that we had them at 80 cents. That meant that the price going up caused revenue to go up. Revenue didn't go down when the price, it went up. So that means that the sweet spot, the price point, was somewhere above 80 cents. Now, did we hit it at 88? I don't know, but it was clear that 88 cents was a smarter price than 80 cents. Because sure, we didn't have a couple of customers. I'm not going to pay 88 cents. I'll pay 80, but I won't pay 88 cents. But those consumers, those customers we kept, brought us more money than the customers that we lost. Now, for sales, sales are always being done just to test to see where we are. Okay, let me give you a classic example. I use this one on students everywhere. Old case study. They did a 20% sale on their shirt. God, it's been a while since I've done it. No, it was pants. They did a 20% off on pants, on this brand of pants. And the revenues on the store sales for the monthly store sales, same store sales, they went up from about $15,000 to $18,000. So again, we had a 20% off sale. And revenues went up from 15 grand to 18 grand on the shoes. Okay? So, which side of the curve were they on? Let me see. You have to do this. Okay, it'd be 18 grand minus 15 grand. It's been so long since I've done this example, I can't remember it myself. Over 15 grand. And so that was $3,000 more dollars over, so that was 1 over 5. Bingo. Now I know why. Now I remember why we use the example. It's a classic example. What do you see? 20% off sale brought up the revenues by, so what do you say? They were right on their sweet spot. See, they were right on it. They were sitting on the pivot. Well, how they did that, I don't know. It was just a guess. But they were right on the pivot. Because when they dropped the price by 20%, revenues, they lost money on, obviously, on the unit price, but they gained revenue on the more customers buying them. But lo and behold, it was an exact wash. Which means that they had, apparently, they were right in the area of the fulcrum. The price point was right there. I'll tell you how important this price point is. One of the ice cream manufacturers was interviewed a couple of years ago. We really know that something is seriously wrong going on in the economy. Prices at the wholesale level. The government massages the numbers, it always has, and it's gotten really serious in the last 10 years. They say, oh, price inflation at wholesale level isn't that bad. Price inflation at the consumer level isn't all that bad. Well, we know that's not true. But we do know this one ice cream manufacturer, you would know the name, he was doing a private interview for Financial Economist. He said, look, the stuff we put in our high-end ice cream, they're just going through the roof. It's just ridiculous. And I said, the interviewer said, well, your prices at the store are staying pretty much the same. He said, I know, right? He said, we found our price point. We're not going to let it go. You're going to just sit here and eat cost increases because of that precious price point? You better believe it. We know where the consumers are. We spent a lot of money to know that that was where those consumers are happy. And if we go off that price point, raise our prices, we're going to lose business. We're going to lose revenue. So in other words, you're sacrificing profit for revenue. Better believe it. Because we're going to hold those customers as long as we possibly can. And that's how crucial these price points are. Once you know what it is, you're not going to yield it, because you know either way you go off that price point, you're going to lose revenue. So it doesn't matter if your costs are going up, you're going to lose revenue either way. So you might as well just sit there on your price point and hold it. And that's why you'll see companies try not to raise their prices on you, because if they've figured out what the price point is, they ain't going to let that go for love or money. Take a break.
Tell you a story before we go on here, just about this. Let
me bring up something about cost. Before I go on, I'm going to do a little supply and demand dynamics before I finish for the night. But I want to bring up one last thing about cost for you. I brought up some of the costs that we don't want to consider when we are in business. Sunk costs, historical costs, and all of that. But there's a cost that I want to bring up now that's really important for you to know about. You decided that you'd had enough of being in college and you weren't living your dream. And so you leave this beautiful place and this happy family that you've had with us here, and you decide, I'm going to start the business that I wanted. You're going to start your own little gas station. You are going to sell gasoline from one of those little gasoline kiosk things where you can go inside, you sell cigarettes, and you in the back you got a little black and white TV, and you change your name to Ed so you can wear a shirt with a circle that says Ed, and you can sit there and sell gas and watch TV and be your own businessman. Well, you're an independent, so you got the Cocaline truck comes by your station to drop off gasoline on its way down, all your competitors down the way. You all keep prices around the same because, you can sell as much gas as you want at a prevailing price. You go too much above that, obviously, they're going to get your business. If you sell below that, that's stupid too. Because you can sell as much as you want prevailing. Well, the Cocaline truck comes by, drops off gasoline, and you pay $3 a gallon, and you get a 20,000-gallon load. Cocaline truck pulls into your, and he's checking his screen, and he says, it's going to be $3 a gallon, so you're good. Now, the markup, typically, on that is 25 cents, so your retail price is going to be $3.25, and so you put your sign, change your sign, $3.25 a gallon. And you wave goodbye to the Cocaline driver. He's going down the road to the next station, and you go back in, and you decide you're going to sit down and watch your TV. So you sit down in your chair, and of course your pants make a crack show and all that good stuff, and you sit there. Well, that's not what I was watching. I was watching Fox News. News from Fox. And when you left, they were just having some stupid-ass interviews. But when you come back, it looks like a movie. There's explosions, and there's fires, and there's this ship in the water that's sinking, a huge ship. And there's like army people running along shooting. And you look at the ticker. Oh, my God. Israel just invaded and bombed Iran's nuclear weapons production facility. War has broken out in the Middle East. Iran responded with two Sukhoi missiles that hit a massive supertanker of oil, and it's sinking. The United States was engaged in a firefight at the Iraqi border, and there are stories that a U.S. warship has just been brought down by a Sunburn missile. The Strait of Hormuz has been mined, and there are ships exploding along the straits right now. United States declares war on Iran. Iran declares war on Israel. Saudi Arabia declares war on Iran and Israel. What the hell? Well, let's just all go to war here. Russia sits back and says, all we wanted was Ukraine. And, oh my God. And you look down the road, And you see the Coca-Cola driver has stopped along the side of the road. He's recalculating prices he's going to charge for gasoline. He pulls into the next station and call, what's he charging you down there? Well, he's charging $8 a gallon to me. So the retail at the station, the next station down the way, goes up to $8.25. The next station goes up to $8.25 in a couple of minutes as the Coca-Cola driver stops there. All along the way, all of the other gas stations paid the higher price, so they had to do that. And there you are with your sign at $3.25. What do you do? To what? $9.25, you son of a bitch. No. What do you change it to? I just go $8.25. Because I can sell all the gas I want at that price. Doesn't matter. The one thing that I sure as hell don't... Well, you know what I'm hearing here is that you people are unethical SOBs. God, he paid $3 a gallon for his gasoline.
He just doubled up $6.50 and made everything that I paid out back plus.
You see, but this is ridiculous. You guys are trying to cheat because you got all you paid $3. And what are you doing? You're taking advantage of people.
Sometimes you sell it for you. Sometimes you gain. Sometimes you lose.
Okay, that's kind of the idea, but it's really more not sometimes. You see, what happens if he sells his gas at $3.25? He won't have enough money to buy his next load. If he sells it at $8, probably won't have enough for his next load because, I mean, he's still, you know, he didn't make any profit for the next round. You see, here's the point. You never price on history. You price on replacement. Replacement cost is all that matters. Replacement cost is all that matters. Historical cost is irrelevant. I'm out of business at $3.25 a gallon. I won't have. Well, our customers love me. They trust me. You know what? If you stay at $3.25, they're going to wipe you out. You're out of business. They'll just drive by. They won't even remember your name was Ed when they go to the next station because they don't give a rat's ass any more about you than you do about them. Get over the ethics of it. $8.25 is what you charge. Because if you charge less, you could very well be out of business. As a matter of fact, that would probably be the low ball. Because if you expect prices to get worse and worse as the war goes on, you might even want a future price. But at least $8.25, because there's no way you're going to survive. They're going to clean you out. The customers are going to line up at your station. You'll have all your gas sold in 2 hours. You won't have enough money to call that Coca-Cola driver to bring him back for more gasoline. You're just done. You're gone. And that's why in business, in economics, in rational action, you charge on replacement, not on history, ever. When you get your education here, well, this education cost me such and such, so, you know, what's it going to cost to replace that education if you have to do it again in 10 years, 20 years? Don't price yourselves low. Have the respect for what you get here and what you get, what you're going to be doing with your life. It's what the market will bear. I mean, these guys are charging $8.25. I mean, you charge less than that. All you're doing is saying, well, I'm going to cut you some slack, consumers. But really, in the end, you're going to hang me out to dry. You're going to take all my gas and you're going to sell it. You're going to buy it. And then, you know, are you going to have a fundraiser to bring me back to business? No, you're not. No. That's why in business we have to price on replacement, not on history. That's why we have to consider everything in terms of replacement, not on the history of what it was. So that's the thing about, well, you know, I paid $300 for this car, so well, what's it going to cost for you to replace that car with something equivalent? If prices have gone up, that's what you're going to. If prices have gone down, that's what you're going to do. but you're not going to price on the history of the product, only on what it's going to cost you to get another one, to get more so you can keep yourselves alive in business. Now, that might sound, but you seem to be okay with this concept. And this is one of those things where we talk like we're vicious, cruel sons of bitches. And the truth of the matter is, yeah, we are. Okay, now, let's move on here. Let me do some supply and demand dynamics here for you a little bit. And I strongly, look, quantity and price, and now we're going to put a demand curve and a supply curve on the same axis, and we're going to draw this equilibrium price in here. This price where the quantity supplied is cleared by the quantity demanded. At lower prices, the quantity supplied won't be as much as the quantity demanded. At higher prices, the quantity supplied will be great, but the quantity demanded won't clear it. There is a price, or at least a price, a range, where you can approximately clear. And that place, we call that the market clearing quantity, equilibrium quantity. It's where the quantity being supplied at that equilibrium price equals the quantity being demanded at that equilibrium price. And, you know, like I said, that price, the clearing is kind of like a fuzzy place too. And I was trying to show you in my example with my own company, you really do feel around in the dark. And it changes too from time to time. Economic situation in the, people's incomes change, tastes and preferences change. So you're always trying to keep ahead of the game, and you're always losing, of course, but there you are. Okay. Now you can do these on graphs, or you can do it a little more simply. You can sort of think about it rationally. What happens if the supply, let's say supply increases, but demand stays the same? What do you suppose is going to happen to the price? If there's more of something out there, what happens to the price? The price drops. And so what's going to happen to the amount that's going off the shelves? Will it increase or decrease? I mean, price has gone down, so you're going to have more selling, more of it clearing the market. So if you drew this with a diagram, you're saying that the supply increases. First, the equilibrium price was here, and the equilibrium quantity was here at supply one. Supply increases to supply two, so the equilibrium price is going to fall, and the equilibrium quantity is going to rise. That's the graph of it, but I try to emphasize that this isn't because of the graph. If you can think about it logically, it probably is going to do you better. Okay, supply went up. Well, if supply goes up, price is going to go down. Well, that's obvious. Well, the price goes down, more of it's going to go off the shelves. That's all this graph is saying. It's saying, it's showing in a graph what is just reasonable to think about. Let's try another one. Suppose the demand for something goes up, but the supply stays the same. Without using a graph, just reasonably, the demand for something has increased. What's that going to cause the price to do with everything else? Yeah, push the price up. Okay, the price is going to be pushing upward because the demand has increased. So does that mean that there's going to be more or less of it probably going off the shelves? If the price has gone up. Let's see. Here was the supply. Here was the demand. Now, there was the original equilibrium clearing price and quantity. Okay, so now we're going to say the demand has increased. So, the demand has increased. So, equilibrium price rises. Equilibrium quantity clearing the market rises, too. Because people just want more of it. So, there's going to be more off the shelves. Even though the price is higher, people want more of it. So there's just going to be more of it going off the shelves. Here's a great example. One of the things that I didn't mention, you know what can really push a demand curve outward? And this is something we do a lot in marketing. It's expectations, not the reality. As a matter of fact, reality is one of the last things we care about in business. It's what we have people expect to happen. So, have any of you ever heard of the Cabbage Patch marketing trick, the Cabbage Patch Gambit? For many years, do you know what Cabbage Patch dolls are?
Yeah.
Okay. For years, all they would do, all the companies that make Cabbage Patch dolls would do is put out a few sort of anonymous press releases that there weren't going to be many Cabbage Patch dolls. So what they did was they created artificial demand. Because what they, you know, they'd simply tell kids, your mom has to buy you a Cabbage Patch doll. If she doesn't, she actually doesn't really love you. You know? So when they would hint that there was going to be a problem with Cabbage Patch dolls, that would create artificial demand. Everyone would run in, buy them, and they would all be sold off the shelves. Then a few days before Christmas, they'd put a whole bunch more on the shelves. Nail those sons of bitches. You see, Apple did it with the first iPhone. They hinted that there were going to be very few of them, and they were selling them at $600. Black market price was $900, just to create artificial demand for them. Huh? Oh, Coke. I mean, they all do that. Yeah, go ahead.
Isn't there, like, what Hostess did, like, 2 years ago?
Oh, yeah. You better believe it. It was all marketing. I mean, we all sat there on the inside. We thought, you sons of bitches. We knew damn well. Because they had even done a movie with the Twinkies in it to hype the demand. What was the movie? Zombieland. It's not the taste. It's the consistency of that coconut. You know, really? Don't forget Double Tap and the cardio, you know, all those things. Yeah, you see, you set it up and then you create the expectation. One of the things you'll notice in the winter is if the National Weather Service says there's a major storm, snowstorm coming, oh, all the damn salt is wiped off the shelves. The shovels are wiped off the shelves at the stores. And then, of course, snow doesn't show up and everyone's like, well, hell. But you're creating artificial demand for something by making people think. And you see, in the long run, they'll figure out that there was bullshit. But it might be a few days. It might be decades. That's why we do the marketing within medicine the way we do. We've overinflated to the point of, you know, we sit back, oh, God, they're going to do this. The serious, terrible problem of autism. Now we're calling almost anything autism. Oh, you farted? That's autistic, man. There was a sign up. 1 in 63 people has autism. Jesus, no wonder I'm so fucked up. You know, this is the way it is. We play the game with you. And eventually people say, you know what? I don't have that disease or this disease. But we can make you afraid. And we can surge your demand. And we can push it outward. That way we can charge more and more sales on the shelves. You understand the trick that we're doing here? We're just playing games with you, okay? But it's okay, because it's for money, and money is important. Now, let me show you something here. I'm going to show you some complicated ones. Some of these, you know, draw the graph, and you'll see the right answer. But you got to be a little careful, because some of them, where both curves are moving at the same time, which is actually kind of really, really what sometimes happens, then you have to kind of think carefully. Look, let me show you something. What happens if supply and demand go up at the same time? Here's supply one. Oh, yeah, that was only demand one. And here's supply one. And here was your original mark, clearing price and your original clearing quantity. Now, you've got to be careful on the graph, because the graph could actually lead you to the wrong answer. I want to show you what's going on here. Okay, the demand going up. That's too tight. You might want to wipe your back off, because she really, I mean, she hosed, man. Okay, if all that happened was the demand going up, you see the price would go up. and the clearing quantity would go up too. No big thing. But the supply going up is causing something to happen counter. When the supply pushes up, and I'll call that supply A and supply B. You notice that it's pretty obvious, it's not even pretty obvious, that supply going up is going to make the market clearing quantity really go up. You see that? Both of the curves are, the curves are reinforcing each other, pushing outward. But look what happened to the price. That's right. The supply force counteracts the demand force. So in the end, we really don't know what happens to price in a situation like this. See, if the demand curve pushed out a lot and the supply curve pushed out a little, you'd probably see a price increase. But if the demand curve had gone out just a little bit, but the supply curve had really surged outward, that probably would have meant that the price would have fallen. So the way we would say this in economic terms is the quantity clearing the market's going to unambiguously go up. No question about it. The amount clearing going off the shelf is going to really go up. But the amount, but the price, well, we don't know what that's going to do. It could go up, it could go down, it could stay the same. I'll show you an example of this. Let me show you a real-world example. And this is, with all these new technologies, I was in college at the beginning of the computer, personal computer age. Actually, I was there before that, but you had these ridiculous prices. An IBM computer with a 10-megabyte hard drive, 10-megabyte hard drive with, that was a dream, 16 kilobytes of RAM. And they promised that these things called modems would be showing up. Oh, man, that was so cool. Price of the system was $10,900. But it was worth it, man. But then the technology began to become more efficient. Now, whenever you have, so let's take something like, have you seen USB flash drives, how they start out, you know, the ones now that, I got it in my case. I got one that's a 64 gigabyte. That's 2 years old. I paid $179 for it. Son of a dog, some place online called, I think it's Newegg. It's got 64 gigabytes now for like $29. Idiots, pisses me off. Look, I guess within like 4 years, they'll have 1 terabyte flash drives. Well, I mean, at a price I can afford, fool. I mean, you know. Yeah, I know. But you know, that'll be cool. You know, I can really store some porno or some stuff on that. Get off me. Okay, now here's what goes on with these technologies. Originally, the supply curve isn't here. There are very few of these because they're very costly to make because of technological capability. There's not a lot of places that can build them. But as time goes on, so the price is stupidly high. And there aren't all that many people who want it anyway. So, but what happens over time is that, first of all, more suppliers come into the market. That's market entry. That always pushes a supply curve outward if more companies start making a product. Also, it gets cheaper to make the product because you just get the efficiencies, the dynamic efficiencies start to set in. It's no longer, well, let's make sure it works this way and put that one in human hands or wiring things together. Eventually, it gets to the point where, for example, do any of you know what an IC board is, an integrated circuit board is? Those green boards with all the stuff on them. Well, you know what? The first ones that were being built in the 1950s and 60s, they were hand-wired. Pss, pss. And then after a while, they had these machines that could do it. And then they figure out, why are we doing it this way? We can take a picture. And then using special films, we can make the picture the board. So the technological routine goes on. More companies making the product, cheaper to make the per unit. And so over a period of time, the supply curve swings outward like that. But at the same time, people are finding uses for these things. And more people, younger people usually, are finding out, well, this thing is cool. I'll try that. So the demand is swinging outward. But usually what happens in a case like this is that the supply curve just keeps pushing outward as the Chinese come in and start building them and stealing the technology. And then the Vietnamese come in, and then the everyone's in there building them. And so the supply curve keeps falling. The demand curve doesn't stand a chance against that. That's why the prices drop so far down at the end of the technology, and they're even at Walmart. You can buy flash drives at Walmart. Whereas in the early days, you had to go to a special store to buy them or to a specialty kind of retailer. By the end, there are so many of them on the shelves that they can be cleared off the shelves everywhere, from Walmart to the computer stores like Best Buy and all of that. They're all selling them. So that's an example where you know what's happening, but you know that the quantities clearing the market is just going to keep going up and up and up. And then eventually there will be people who figure out, oh, well, we can use these. And another thing that happens too, are any of you old enough to remember records? Oh, yeah, well, you could bite me. Yeah, you mean those old-fashioned things that, you know, people back in the Middle Ages? Yes, I know, whatever. Bite me. And then after that, there was an interim technology. The demand actually never picked up too hard for it. It was reel-to-reel tapes were never really that convenient. But there was an interim technology. Does anyone know what the interim technology was?
Was it a laser disc?
Nope. Oh, no. This is before that. No. Eight-track tapes. Eight-track tape, that was back in the 70s. And I still have mine, and I have C.W. McCall's Convoy. Never mind. Okay, anyway. And then the cassette players came out, and they surged. Supply was very limited on the original Sony Walkmans. Demand wasn't strong, but then the other companies started making cassette players that were small, portable. And then more people began to embrace the technology. And more people who didn't have records were coming into the market as adults, and so they didn't have a stake in the old technologies. And as time went on, that one surged, and then suddenly another one came online. It was called the CD. That was a big, big thing. And that one surged, and more companies came out with CD players, and the price of the CD players kept falling and falling, and the demand kept slipping upward, but the demand never really went as far as the supply did. So the price kept falling, even though the demand was coming up, which pushed the price up a little bit. And then finally, the technology that's now out there is the what? The MP3, the MP3 technology. But that, and of course, you can get an MP3 player on eBay for $5. But that one is going to just keep getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. People will keep moving into that, although that one's going to have more problem because so many people have a stake in the CDs. They have big collections of CDs. But then the next technology will come along. And then the MP3 players will no longer be interesting. But that technology is still about 5 years away. Anyone know what it is? The technology is called Borging, from the term in Star Trek, where the people were captured by Borgs, a race that would insert modules into them and make them hear, and do what they were told. Borging technology is already available, and there's some kids experimenting with it in Japan and South Korea, and it will become more popular. Essentially, it's a module that you'll be able to plug in, and it will have learning modules, music modules, and the cool ones will be that it will record the talents of, say, a great pianist, and then you can put that in. You can play the piano like that. You can listen to music. You can transcribe from your thoughts to driving to talking to your computer, living in your gaming world. 5 years. You think I'm joking? 5 years to that, 20 years to teleportation, 50 years to speed hyperspeed light travel to the stars in your lifetimes, all of this. You think your parents are bitchy at you about getting tats? Wait until you see your kids coming home with a module they can plug in their USB port. That's just going to piss you off. That's all I have for you tonight. Go home.